Jesse. How you doing?
What's up, Corey, man? What's happening?
I got another deep question for you.
Uh-oh, deep thoughts.
Would you rather be an average person in the present? So, like yourself, no offense.
I'm not average, but go ahead.
Or a king of a large country 2,500 years ago?
The king. It's good to be the king.
but think about it. Why? I mean, I guess think about all the things an average person.
I'm kind of a elitist snob anyway, so I could definitely picture myself being the ruler of many subjects.
Oh, so you just more egotistical. You just want people to
bow down to Xerxes.
But think about all the things you would not have. Like,
you're the king. What do you not have if you're the king?
An iPhone.
Man, I don't care about no iPhone. Come on, dude. Really?
All right.
You got like concubines.
I knew that was coming high on the list.
Sorry, I'm just kidding. Well, I mean, Solomon had like, what, 900 concubines. I'm kidding.
You think your bed 2,500 years ago felt better than your bed?
I would sleep on my subjects, a bed of my lowly subjects.
I hope they're fat.
Oh, I would get all the fat people in the kingdom to lay down for me to bed down every night, and they would carry me around.
I still don't think that'd be comfortable.
Man.
I'm still, actually, the more I think
have
about
you ever,
it.
Have you ever laid on top of a fat person? I have.
I've tried to cut back.
Well, it's been many years. Been many, many, many years.
I don't like where this is going.
You know, there was this one time at band camp.
Okay. Hey, what's up, everybody? My name is Corey Nolan. I am a photographer, musician, living in the great state of Alabama. Did I say that convincingly?
It's a great state.
Yeah. You have traveled a lot in your past. Yeah. I travel a lot. Well, when I was working before the pandemic, yes. I was traveling a lot. And I think it's a great place.
It is a great place to live.
We have some issues, but I've also see that everywhere.
That's everywhere. And you have to go away to appreciate. Like,
yeah.
Oh, we don't. I always tell my friends from like California and like up north that they should never come here, that it's horrible. We still have dirt roads, you know, it's oppressive, and because I don't want them to move here and make it like Nashville.
Well, California, those people are usually disappointed when they get here because of bugs and humidity.
Yeah, but like, man, they can have so much more land and real estate for like half of what they're paying in L.A.
That is true.
California, yeah.
That is true. Just with venomous snakes and...
I mean, you know, you got to take your good with the bad.
And this over here is...
Hello, this is Jesse Settle reporting with brother Corey Nolan. Happy to see you all. Oh, I can't see you. I can't see you.
I don't even know your weird references.
Oh, that was maybe some Austin Powers or something.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Do you listen to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend?
No, but I love Conan.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Mike Myers was on there
yeah.
a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, Conan's one of my favorites.
Mine too. He is the hardest working. Were we having this conversation recently? I was having it with somebody. I think that when a little more time passes and we stop associating him with like TBS
mm-hmm.
and the kind of debacle at NBC,
right.
we're going to look at him as probably the greatest of our era. That's my opinion. Because
talk show generation.
Yes, because he continued to reinvent himself. He is genuinely funny. Like he cannot turn it off. He's one of those like cursed type people.
Right.
I'm sure he is an awful person to be around, but he is extremely good at what he does. And I think that he's influenced a lot of people.
And he really loves music and musicians. Like he's always really, really grateful to the musicians that play on his show and always talks to them and seems really genuinely interested. And he wrote for The Simpsons. So
yeah, he wrote The Simpsons, yeah.
I mean, you know.
That's kind of, I feel like when people talk about him, that's the like highest mark on his resume. I mean, is that he, the people that know that and care about obviously The Simpsons, but that it's such a high, held in high esteem.
I mean, you know, that's my dream.
To write for The Simpsons?
Or just to be like, you know, on there, an episode like.
Yeah. How do you feel about South Park?
You guys.
Did you like South Park?
I like you.
Is this still on?
I think it is. And I don't really watch it all the time or anything, but when I do, it always just like, it flabbergasts me because it's like, oh, these guys just don't care.
They don't care.
But they're usually spot on.
Okay. So that's, I've kind of pushed this into a corner. So on the spot on part, so Token, since this is a race podcast. So one of my favorite episodes, I laughed the hardest.
When he was a bass player?
When he was a bass player.
Yeah.
I mean, is that, I know like, it's pretty
Token,
racist.
You go home and get your bass, man. You bet you got a bass. I do not, Cartman. I know what I have. Now go home, Token. Just go down in your basement. And he gets down there. He's like, shit.
And he can actually play. It's like, boom, 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 boom. Yeah, that's one of my favorite ones, too.
Okay.
All
right. Okay, good. I'm just making sure that it's okay that I like that as much as I do.
I mean,
I don't
you know,
secretly laugh. Because that's the thing. That is a thing that is true of people like myself. We being white, a person like myself, is that we kind of have those closet moments of laughter over things that we're not sure if they're appropriate enough.
That's funny because it's like, you know, I mean, stereotypes are funny because they're funny because a lot of times they're true. What gets weird is though when like your close white friends think it's okay to call you Token. I'm like, bruh, come on, dude. That's like pushing the line a little too far.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah.
But you know, I do feel like Token sometimes.
And in your position, because you often are in predominantly white circles.
Yeah, it's like I feel like Token.
You kind of play that role, and then my job is marketing, and I'm in a lot of different types of, you know, places that have some are very diverse, some are either, you know, all black or all white, and so it can go both ways. But it's kind of funny to watch the people who have been pulled out for marketing purposes because this wasn't the first time that's happened to them. This happened like ever since they were, you know, old enough to realize what was going on.
Right.
And they've always been that Token guy.
Well, so. I mean, yeah. I mean, I could show you, my mother made me a scrapbook. I didn't know she was making me a scrapbook, but she gave it to me and it had a bunch of pictures of like my grade school class pictures. And I'm like the only spot that's like to like fourth grade, maybe, or fifth grade. I'm like the only black kid.
Where'd you go?
I was living in Maryland
and
Delaware up until like fourth, fifth. I didn't move down here till like eighth grade, seventh, eighth grade.
I didn't realize that.
So like, yeah, I was definitely, you know, one or maybe the only one of my hue. And
what hue is that? What Pantone number is that?
I don't know what copper tone number I
is
am.
Isn't that Pantone?
You know, like
I rode
my motorcycle the other day without a jacket on, and like I actually got a little darker, and I was like, yeah.
Yeah, you are several different shades.
Yeah. Right, look at that.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Did you know that black people can get sunburn?
Yeah, actually, my sixth grade teacher told me that.
Yeah, like, I remember.
She was black, by the way. It wasn't just like a racist moment.
She's like, hey, we can get the skin, it burned. We get the skin.
All right, well, we're like 10 minutes and we've done nothing towards anything that constructive. So, well, we are doing a podcast that is hopefully starting a proper conversation about race between two people that came from different backgrounds and who are, it's not just now, we've been having this conversation for a long time, you and I have, and have a lot of respect for you and just really think a lot of what you've brought to me, to my music, the ways that you have engaged in my life and the ways that you have affected and influenced my community. And I consider it, this really is a privilege for me to be able to be the one sitting down and talking with you about things that are, we've been making light of a lot of things, but there are obviously a lot of very serious and pressing things that are going on around us right now. So the question that we want to address today and spend a little time on is talking about how did we get here? Here being the systemic racism that we are hearing more about. If you are white, you're hearing that phrase more. You've always heard that. If you were black, things that are coming a little more to the surface in the last week, unfortunately, because of things that have happened, but also fortunately, because people are becoming more aware of it. How did these things that have been in place, these ways of life, the treatment of each other, how did they get to be what they are in the year 2020, which feels like it should be like, when you say 2020, doesn't it feel like it should be like way in the future? We should be flying around and racism like, should not be so much of a thing.
I am so upset that we do not have transporters and I can't be beamed up. And yeah, I mean, I'm kind of let down. White people let me down.
Well,
Star Trek let me down.
Yeah.
You know,
well, it wasn't all white on Star Trek.
Star Trek actually was the first show that had an interracial kiss between Captain Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura.
Was that also an inter, what would you call an alien?
No, what an interspecies. She's just a black chick, man.
I don't know anything about Star Trek.
It wasn't like Spock and like, no, man, she's just black chick.
I don't even know if William Shatner, was he a human?
I'll take
in
you
that?
Upstairs and show you. I got all the figures. I'll show you. So Captain Kirk, the white guy, kissed the black chick. And I've heard a legend that when
we're still that, so far
that,
off
that I know that when that got ready to broadcast in Alabama, that somebody climbed up to the tower up there where WBRC is and actually cut the feed.
Oh,
because they couldn't let that be shown down
what
here.
What year would that have been?
It was probably last week.
It was a rerun.
Yeah, it's like, no, we can't have that.
Well, you know, we didn't talk about it in the last episode, but, and I don't really want to spend a whole lot of time on it right now because there's so many things we want to talk about in this episode, but Birmingham did remove its Confederate monument. What are your thoughts on that happening now and the fact that it did happen? What do you think?
So I was a history minor in college, and I grew up in close to Chickamauga battlefield in Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia. I was actually born in the middle. I mean, I was born in Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia, which was like a Confederate enclave during the Civil War. So I was very familiar with Civil War monuments and its history. And I get it. You know, a lot of people died, man. A lot of people died. And commemorating people that fought, even though what they may have been fighting for was not necessarily right in some people's eyes, still a human life. And a monument to a fallen soldier is one thing, and I get that, to people who died in battle. A monument to just a Confederate general, because he was a general in the Confederate Army. Confederate monuments do one thing to black people. They remind us of a time in our history when we were slaves. That's all that signifies to black people. When I ride down, I guess that's 65 South to Montgomery, there's a giant Confederate memorial.
Daughters of Confederacy, yeah. I think.
Whoop-de-doo. I'm like, you know what I think every time I pass one? And this is how the media plays on your brain and like TV. I think, and I see the General Lee. The car from Dukes of Hazzard.
Did you watch Dukes of Hazzard?
Oh, like all the time.
Did you take away that at the time?
So we were watching it once. My brother and I and my Uncle Jesse asked my mom. I remember him asking her like, "What?" He's like,
"Wait, your Uncle Jesse?"
Yeah.
Okay. That's still the punchline?
Yeah, that's not the punchline, but that's funny. I just thought about it. So my Uncle Jesse, not the Uncle Jesse on Dukes of Hazzard, asked my mother why she was letting us watch that. And she's like, oh, it's just they love the car. And like, you know, And he was like, but they're Confederates. Like, you know, like they're glorifying the Confederacy and like white supremacy. And like, she was like, I don't think that that's what they're thinking. They're thinking that they have a cool car and they go out and they beat up the, you know, the dumb sheriff every week. But I remember that conversation that they had, and I still actually love the Dukes of Hazzard. I actually tried to watch it not too long ago and was like, this is so dumb. But like all 70s TV shows are pretty much dumb. I've come to realize, you know, the fact that we still have monuments to the Confederacy and the fact that we have laws that say that you will be fined if you tear them down, you know, just reiterates the point that white supremacy is still a thing in America and that we don't want you to forget your place. That's what it says to me. Okay. Now, do I think we should just go out and start tearing down monuments? No. But I think that there should be a systematic effort to remove things, not to erase history, but to remove vestiges of racial segregation in this country. It never fails to like just amaze me when I see neighborhoods like subdivisions that are named like Plantation Cove or right. Like, I'm like, why would you name something Plantation or the Preserve? I'm like, what are you preserving? You know, or schools, I think they renamed the school down the street Heritage. Like, those are code words to black people. That's saying that, like, we are going to keep our white heritage in the forefront and that we will never forget and we don't want you to forget your place.
Yeah. As a white person who is around many white people who embrace those kind of things, and I look at them and I think, I don't think of you as a racist. Like, I don't think of you and as someone who wants to do harm to someone, or I don't think of them as thinking that much of anybody else other than kind of themselves and where they are. I don't want to get too political, but that's kind of the same idea of making America great again, which for a lot of people, they are sort of happy about thinking of another time.
Right, nostalgic,
when
right.
Yeah, they're nostalgic for another time, which I don't think that they're out wanting to push somebody down. But what they're not considering in that is that if you reverse time, or if you long for something that was in the past, well, you are having to accept the things that are affecting other people and that they're affecting other people negatively. And there has been some progress over time that has allowed people to not want people like yourself, people of color, to not to look back and be like, no, I don't want to rewind
right.
50 years.
Yeah, when was it ever great for black people in this country? Like, when was America ever great for black people in this country?
Yeah, it's not yet come.
It has not, thank you, it has not yet come. And, you know, I mean, being a musician, I'm like, man, it would have been really cool to live like during like the 40s and, you know, the jazz age, or maybe in the 20s. And then I'm like, it wouldn't have been, because I'm like, with my mouth, they probably would have shot me or hung me.
Yeah.
And I have a tendency to like marry white women. So
it definitely would have hung me.
Probably would have hung me. Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, this is leading up to what we want to talk about today, how we got to where we are. And I just want to take a minute or two, and I just want to run down some historical facts. So at this point, there are people who are black in this country who did not come from an African-American culture. There are some. There are people that have immigrated from other places, or maybe they did come from there, but it was via Europe or some other area. That being said, I don't know the statistics on this. I don't think that there are statistics that could accurately say this, but especially in the South, and when you look at the way people have settled over the last 300 years, there's a lot of ancestry to Africans. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these things we're talking about have generationally affected the people of color that we're looking at and around. Just as a little history lesson. So slavery first is documented. They're probably bringing over before 1619. His first document is 1619. You know, some of the stuff was kind of, when I was looking this up, was my memory is jogged from like whatever I learned this in, like maybe high school.
Right.
But even that's another episode for how the textbooks are.
All the books.
My dad said that the other day. He found one of his textbooks and I can't remember the context. The idea though was that like he didn't realize like how, like what a slant there was on.
It's called His Story.
Oh.
Yeah, it's not called Our Story. It's called His Story.
So before 1619, they were actually, so white people, indentured servants, were Europeans, poor Europeans. Mm-hmm. And they figured out that it can be a lot cheaper. There's a lot more. And so Africa was essentially stripped of its strongest and best and brought over here. So 6 to 7 million were brought over in the 18th century, which sounds like a lot, but that was nothing compared to what it would end up being. And the cotton gin, so slavery was actually kind of, they were wondering if it was going to last or not, because there was not, the things that they were farming were not as in demand. The soil had dried up for tobacco. There wasn't as much need for these workers. And then Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin. And so that's where the South really comes more into play. And when that happened, plantations boomed and there was this massive need for the industry of slavery. So you have a massive influx in that. As these things increased, you began to have revolts and things like that. So you began to see laws against anything other than being a slave. So there was a Fugitive Slave Act of 1793, made it a crime to assist a slave in escape. Because some people actually had a conscience about this. Some white people even had a conscience about this back then. But it was tied to money. It was tied to people of influence. And so we began to see these laws come in that kind of keep the system in place. Eventually, we get to the abolition of slavery in 1865, which, you know, obviously prospect of that result in the Civil War. And the result of having abolished a system that had been so relied on by white people to make money, to run these plantations and to...
It's free labor.
Free labor, yeah. And you remove that. So what are they going to do? The next thing that we start seeing is what they call black codes. Black codes, they were forced into year-long contracts, and they were very strict on whether if they broke those contracts, they would be arrested. They would even be killed for breaking those contracts. People then didn't have anywhere to go, so they were
going back to the plantations.
Yeah, and if they didn't have a place to work at that point,
vagrants,
mm-hmm. they were picked up. So you imagine like being released as a slave into a society that didn't have a place for you. You didn't have any land. So you have to go back to the places that you were working as a slave. That's their only hope. And the times that they don't, then they're
arrested.
They're arrested. Yeah. In some states, in these black codes, they were only allowed to be farmers or servants unless they paid a tax. They could get outside of what they were doing as slaves, but it cost them like $100 a year, up to $100 a year, which I can't even imagine how much that was back then. And in 1867, the Civil Rights Act forced Southern states to ratify the 14th Amendment, which gave anyone born in the U.S. equal rights. So you can start to see this transitioning more towards kind of, quote, equality, which is then going to, these folks are going to get more creative with how they continue to.
You mean the whites with their laws?
The whites with laws.
Yeah.
In 1870, the 15th Amendment gave black people the right to vote.
Black men the right to vote.
Yeah. By the 1870s, Southern states had nullified the 14th and 15th Amendment, and they began to enact the Jim Crow laws. The Jim Crow laws were laws that were enacted to kind of
subjugate black people. Yeah.
In 1880s, and I thought this was really interesting, the Jim Crow laws were looser. And I took this to mean less dangerous in the bigger southern cities than they were in rural South, mm-hmm. which you could imagine. So many black people moved to the cities, causing an influx of population.
That makes sense.
I think that's what we see now, even. Yeah. I mean, this was 130 years ago. That influx caused the laws to get even worse, stricter. Stricter. And so segregation expands, the Klan expands, lynchings increase. By 1948, it took till 1948 for the military to be integrated. By 1954, Brown versus Board ended segregation at schools. So prior to that point, you had to go to separate schools.
Supposedly separate, but equal schools.
What you see at this point is an increase in rezoning, an increase in privatization of schools, and you see new municipalities begin to spring up. And that, these things that we're talking about now are things that
continue in our lives.
In 1965, the voting rights finally allowed minorities to vote, which is what the Civil Rights Act essentially led to.
That's when black women got the right to vote too, finally. Because
when did women get in general get to vote?
Suffrage was in the 1920s.
Okay.
So before then, you know, only white women were given the right to vote. By, you know, white men were like, okay, white women can vote, but black women weren't given the right to vote. So white men could vote, white women, and black men. Black women weren't given the right to vote until 1965.
In 1968, they passed the Fair Housing Act, which my understanding is that was, it made it illegal to discriminate who you sold a house to, who you could rent to. Right. So these are sort of bullet points along the line of almost 400 years. But when you look at it in mass and sequentially, you can see that there was a constant evolution on, if we're going to draw sides and we say there was one group of people who began this and they were European, and there was another group of people who were brought into this, and they eventually, through this line of these acts and these things that happen in our country, were given certain rights, they were made, quote, equal, you still continue to see these two groups operating in very different capacities from each other, but in very similar ways as they always have been.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, kind of the names are different.
Two Americas.
Two Americas.
We've had definitely two Americas since the slaves were freed. Before the slaves were freed, I would say that there was one white supremacist, racist institution, and everyone was like, you either fall in line or you pay the consequences. After the Civil War, you had, like you said, you had two separate entities trying to, at some junctures, trying to like integrate and become one, but there was always blowback, typically from the South, to keep black people from achieving true equality. You know, segregationists would probably tell you that they're not racist. They would tell you that they're just doing what's natural according to nature, that, you know, that blacks and whites are different and they need to be separate, or that this is God's, you know, plan. You know, segregationists and racists have always used religion to back up or, you know, pseudoscience to back up their claims to why the races should be separate. And, you know, the old saying is, every time we take one step forward, we get knocked two steps back. You know, like we had Obama for what, eight years?
Yep.
And now, right after Obama, what happened?
We swing the other way.
We swung completely the other way. And why? That's how it's always been with America. We progress a little bit, and then we backslide. We progress a little bit, then we backslide.
Would you say that it's a 1-1-4-2 back? Because it does seem black people, African American people specifically, and how much they've endured is unfathomable.
It's unfathomable.
So I guess my question, do you think it's a 1-4-2 back, or do you think there actually is progress being made?
I really, at this point where we are today in 2020, it seems like it's 1-4-2 back. When is America going to, when I say America, I mean the system of American capitalism that was built on the backs of free labor that was brought here in bondage. When is it going to atone and make amends for its transgressions against the people that it brought here in bondage and made its fortune on? The American dream is just that for a lot of Black Americans. It's a dream. The images we see on TV of, like, you know, the picket fence and the, you know, the 2.5 kids and two car garage. I mean, I'm grateful, and I realize that in a lot of ways I'm living that dream. I am the product and the realization of Martin Luther King's dream. Okay. But I often wonder, to be honest, if I could have achieved this dream or this state of where I am had it not been for the fact that I'm married to someone that is white. Okay. When we went to buy this house, I specifically told my wife that she needed to find a realtor and that she needed to meet with him first. Now, we had a good realtor. I think he was a good, fair guy, and we knew what we wanted. But because I'm not unaware of the politics in play and the covenants in play, I knew that it would be better if I stayed out of the picture for a while. And of course, you know, white, intelligent, polite society is such that we went and looked at some houses. This one particular house that we looked at, the guy was really eager to, like, meet with us and, you know, trying to sell. And when he got there, I could see on his face that he was, like, having second, you know.
This is the seller?
Yeah, this is the seller. Mm. This house had belonged to his parents. And he had started to, you know, redo it. You know how we do over in these neighborhoods. We take older houses and update them and then sell them for a bunch of money. I really felt that because I was Black, that he started to kind of backtrack. Like, he was, well, you know what? I mean, I think that we're just going to, you know, he kept, like, making excuses of like, what he wanted to do to this house before he really wanted to put it on the market. And
because if you let one Black guy in,
well, I mean, you know, I don't know how many Black people live in Green Valley, but I would imagine there aren't many.
Yeah.
You know, and why is that? I think part of that is that it's like an unspoken, these covenants that I mentioned to you before, that these are a real thing, that these are basically, you know, promises that white people have made to one another, that we won't sell these houses to a Black family or Black people because they feel that that will lessen their property values. Okay. Now, you and I live in the same neighborhood, and the houses in this neighborhood are starting to be on the increase once again. And we don't live in mansions, but what these houses go for over here, a lot of Black people wouldn't be willing to pay for a house this size.
Yeah.
And you and I have talked about this because, for one, they feel like that their money could be better spent on a newer house, bigger house. But it's not lost on me that the property values remain high because it's intentional to keep Black people from wanting to buy houses in this area, you know? So,
and I'm not speaking for this area, because I don't know that stuff specifically here, but it certainly could be true. And, but I will, you know, it's pretty easy to think of other neighborhoods that are more established. So that the more established neighborhood, the more opportunity there is for that.
They don't have, it's not that Black people don't have money to buy houses in those neighborhoods. Why is it that they don't buy homes in those neighborhoods? That's my question. Or why, you know, I mean, why are they still predominantly white neighborhoods? It's not that black people have money now.
Yeah.
You know, especially like in these newer subdivisions, like down at Ross Bridge area. I'm like, there's a lot of diversity down there. Why is it that in like Homewood, Vestavia, certain parts of Hoover, definitely Mountain Brook, people of color still don't own property or homes in those areas?
Yeah. I read an article. It was after the shooting at the Galleria, and this, you know, these things keep flaring up every so often. But, and it was an interview with a Black man talking about why he moved to Hoover, and he was talking about how he had pressure to stay in the community that he came up in. He was considering going back to that community at this point. He came to Hoover for, you know, the reasons that you would think, like for schools, kids to have
schools, and that kind of stuff.
Made my eyes open, like, oh, like there's probably a lot of people that are living in parts of town that are maybe have less property value, that they live there because they want to, because they feel more comfortable there.
Exactly.
They're among people that are similar to them, or they won't get harassed like you have been. Yeah. And life is just a little bit simpler. Mm-hmm. So back to the point of, you know, I would say that if we're talking in percentages, the people that have that opportunity to move to another place are in the minority. Minority for sure. In a minority.
For sure.
The vast majority of the people are stuck in a place True. That they probably would want something better for mm-hmm. their children, would move to somewhere else if they had the opportunity. Now, that would have its own challenges, like the things that guy was talking about in that article, but they don't even have that opportunity to do that. And what I have been realizing more and more over the years is that you still have a system that is just not set up to be equal. Like how do you say to people, after all the things that we just read of the timeline of how people have been treated and the laws that have been pushed against them, and then one day those laws are switched and that's lifted, kind of back to it's almost the same idea with back to slavery. It's like, okay, now you're not a slave.
Right.
Well, where in the hell are you going to go?
Yeah, because like, you've already
can't be equal.
Right.
You can't will yourself right, to be equal.
You've started at a disadvantage. Like if this were a race, you would already, you know, if it was a mile race, white people are already a quarter of a mile ahead, or half a mile ahead of the average black person. Mm-hmm. Okay. Most black people can't trace their lineage back more than a few generations. Mm-hmm. Okay. I know for a fact that my great, great, great grandfather he actually got his 40 acres, and the community where my mother now lives and my uncles and my cousins.
Explain that. What was the 40 acres?
So after the slaves were freed, the government enacted a policy that the newly freed slaves were to be given 40 acres and a mule to help give them a chance to be on equal footing, more or less, with their white counterparts. You know, give them some land, give them something that they can have ownership. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sadly, hardly anyone received that. Mm-hmm. All right. So if you don't have any lineage of property and of economic standing in your family, you can't pass that on. Wealth is something that is passed on generation to generation. Mm-hmm. Even, like you said, even after the slaves were freed, even if they were given their 40 acres, this is what happened to my great-great-great-grandparents. They didn't know, they hadn't been taught really how to hold on to their wealth. Mm-hmm. So they had this land, and eventually, because the taxes weren't paid on this land, it ended up getting bought from under them and turning it, you know, making a profit on it. And the thing is, wealth is something that has to be taught, wealth building. You know, you can't just give somebody money or land and say, here you go. They don't know how to keep it.
Right.
And that's essentially the problem in America, is that not only have black people not been given anything to start with, once they did achieve a little bit of wealth or a little bit of money, because like you said, wealth is a whole different thing than having some money. Once we did get some money, we didn't really know how to hold on to it.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't know how to handle that, that's why we have story after story of musicians and athletes. You know, like, how is MC Hammer broke?
Yeah.
I bet you probably bought that CD.
I did.
I did not.
That's why we pray.
Yeah, that's right. It's like MC Hammer should be like one of the wealthiest artists on the planet. He's not, yeah. You know, because nobody showed him how to hold on to his money. You know, black people are notorious consumers. We like new and flashy things.
Well, in his defense, he employed his neighborhood.
I was going to say, yeah.
He had a lot of dancers,
too. Well, that's the other thing, too. The other thing is that, like, talking about how we got here. So both my parents went to college. My dad didn't finish. My mother did. But they both ended up having, at the time, what people call good jobs. My mother was a school teacher. My father drove a truck for Burlington Industries. Okay. That's two pretty decent incomes. Okay. Especially for black Americans during the late 60s, early 70s.
Sure.
Now, I pretty much have lived middle class my whole life, and that's the kind of lifestyle that they afforded me, and I'm grateful for. But with the money that they were making, they should have been able to parlay that into more wealth, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But you know why? One of the major reasons they didn't, it wasn't that they were out just buying ridiculous, stupid things all the time. It was because black people feel an obligation once they move up a little bit to reach back and help those who have not been able to achieve what they have.
Mm.
So my mother was sending money home to like her mother, and she was helping her sisters, and you know, they're helping all these people in their family.
Yeah.
You know, meanwhile, trying to raise a family of their own and maintain a household.
Yeah.
Okay. How are you going to build wealth when you're trying to take care of, like you said, the whole neighborhood?
Mm. Yeah. I mean, that's such a, it's such a noble thing.
It is a noble thing. But I mean,
but you can't, but when the cards are stacked against so many people and those people are in a family unit, if one person does, it sort of, I won't say it, well, it does kind of bring them down, because if the whole thing is not rising at that same rate, then it doesn't allow the people inside of that to make it to the next.
Right. Yeah. You can't move to the next level. And I mean, I actually have an uncle who made millions of dollars and has a bunch of property in Maryland. And, you know, he was a retired colonel from the military. And, but even he doesn't have the kind of wealth and clout that someone in his position that may have been white could have, because he was helping, you know, he's been helping the family.
Mm-hmm. All right. So our moment of levity here, to quickly shift back and talk about a little bit of music. Jesse, we have talked about the blues.
The blues.
Who do we owe the most to when it comes to the development of modern music?
Robert Johnson.
So you feel like you have to go, when was Robert Johnson?
The 20s.
Okay, so he still wasn't like, so he was like.
He only made like basically maybe two albums worth of recordings. I don't even think that. Like, I have it up there.
Well, what about?
There were field recordings. You know, he died when he was young. But pretty much the whole kind of canon of popular. Now, we're talking about rock music and blues. And yeah, that style of music, I would say Robert Johnson.
Okay. What, is there a different answer for something else?
I mean, to me, you got Robert Johnson, Louis Armstrong, and Charlie Parker.
But you're still kind of late, I feel like, right?
I mean, that's like the early, like...
Like, when was W.C. Handy? He was like 19th century,
well,
right?
No, the 20th century. You know why he's important, right?
I don't.
Because he was the first...
Mark Cohn?
Oh, W.C. Handy... Oh my gosh.
Because
you know Mark Cohn played like at the Hoover Library.
I saw that show. Yeah.
What?
Did you see it?
No, man. I was like, that can't be real.
It was actually pretty great.
I bet. I mean, that's, you know, he's a good songwriter. W.C. Handy was the first person to like notate, like write down the blues so that it could be played by, you know, people that weren't quote unquote blues musicians.
Okay.
That's why he's important.
But he predated those guys.
Not by much. I mean, like, what's the St. Louis Blues and all? Yeah, I mean.
When did you say?
Louis Armstrong, like Hot Fives and Hot Sevens. That's pretty early.
Your Robert Johnson is your answer for the most influential, because why?
Without Robert Johnson, I don't think you would have had the development of the American art form known as rock and roll. To me, started with Robert Johnson.
Okay.
I mean, it was blues, but it was rhythm and blues, rock and roll.
So you're choosing him because he was a transitional figure from the blues into rock and roll.
Chuck Berry, like definitely like all the blues, like British blues guys, like Clapton and Jimmy Page,
the Stones, like, yeah, all them credit.
None of that would have happened without Robert Johnson.
Absolutely. Right.
Okay. Louis Armstrong, I mean, there wouldn't have been Charlie Parker without Louis Armstrong or Miles Davis or any of those guys. I mean, he pretty much invented what we call jazz, you know. No, you can't say someone invented a musical art form, but I mean, he is kind of the cornerstone.
Yeah, well, they put their spin on it and it became something different.
Yeah, it's like, you know, he was the one that everybody was trying to imitate. And then, of course, the late, great Little Richard, who just died. Mm-hmm. Little Richard and Chuck Berry, more rock bands, all rock bands owe more to Chuck Berry and Little Richard than anybody else. I mean, there would be no Elvis without Chuck Berry, pretty much, you know?
Yeah. I figured you'd pick the black man. See, my answers were Jimmie Rodgers.
Jimmie Rodgers is freaking great. I love Jimmie Rodgers.
I'm just kidding.
No, Jimmie Rodgers, Singing Break, man. Like, I listen to, I have one of his albums. Like, that's very haunting to me. Like, I can't really listen to Robert Johnson, Charlie Parker, or Jimmie Rodgers in length or a lot, because it's so, like, it's like this netherworld, like it comes from another place. It's like, it's so powerful. And, you know, like, dude, Jimmie Rodgers, like, died from, like, what, TB?
I don't know.
Yeah, he died from, like, TB, you know, when he was young. So he was still out trying to, that's why he ended up becoming a singer. Just, like, their whole, like, auras were just, like.
Oh, man, life is hard.
Well, you know.
That's why they're singing the blues.
Yeah. You would think during this pandemic we.
I guess he's technically country, though.
Yeah,
Jimmie Rodgers.
That's a white man's blues.
Yeah,
I think country music, real country music, is white man's blues. What I'm looking for is out of this pandemic is for some like new emergent art form to emerge. You know, like I'm like, what's going to be the blues that was born out of the pandemic and all of this?
Yeah, that would be nice. I think we're
due. I think we're due, but I mean, it's still like.
Well, you know what you're going to get a lot of out of this is computer generated music, because people can
stuck in the house.
Yeah. They're going to do it by themselves, which is I've tried to do some of that myself. You and I have talked about like digital drums and things.
I mean, I like playing around with my what is it called, GarageBand. That's fun.
Well, yeah, and even like, you know, steps up from that or
Fruity Loops.
There's some pretty sophisticated stuff.
Right.
So the people that can do that and make actual good music doing that. That's pretty incredible.
Form. Yeah,
it certainly is.
Totally.
But it's going to be in that vein from the pandemic.
You think so?
It has to be, because people just aren't like getting together and jamming right now.
I don't know. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm all about like some crazy futuristic Radiohead, Pink Floyd, Jimi Hendrix, crazy like future space rock. Like, bring it on, man. Bring it on.
I know. I know this pandemic has been tough, and I've literally, my income has been wiped out. Like, I'm not, this is like one of the few times I've felt
black.
Black. Yeah.
I was like, now you know what it feels like to be black, Corey.
Things like, I was thinking about this the other day, like the Spanish influenza lasted a couple of years.
I mean, this might last.
It might, but more likely the way that we roll, because we are just
idiots. Well, we're egotistical.
Yeah. And maybe they were too, but we also have a lot more science on our side. So it's going to be a shorter run. But my point is, we are going to look at 2 months and be like, that was our Great Depression.
You know? I had to laugh. Yeah. You know? I'm like, as broke as I am, I haven't missed a meal. My lights haven't been turned off. Like, I still have a car.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, I mean.
Yeah, there was no Dust Bowl.
Right. It's like, dude, I'm like, we're not struggling.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I don't like it, but I'm just saying.
I don't like it.
I don't think we've been pressed to the point of generating something like the blues.
I mean, I think you're right. You're right. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, like all of this racial strife and
there you go. Know, that's different.
Like that stirs up a lot of emotions. I mean, like, you know, a lot of art is created out of anger and anguish. So, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
But like, no, definitely. Like, I haven't really lost any weight, but I'm trying not to gain any. And it's like, it's hard because it's like, well, let me see, it's time to eat again, you know?
It's like, just all eating.
It's all eating and sleeping, you know? That's why I'm like, me and the dog, let's go for a walk, you know? So,
like in the afterlife, when you meet up with someone who survived the Great Depression, you're like, that was really hard, wasn't it? Like, all I could do was eat.
Man, I mean,
like really? Because I mean, couldn't find anything to eat.
It's like, man, it was so hard. Like, I mean, the ice cream shop would close at 5 o'clock. It was so depressing.
And then there was this like curfew. And
nah, I'm not going to lie. The curfew bothered me yesterday because I was out on my motorcycle and I was way out in Leeds. And it was like 6 o'clock, and I was like, holy crap, I got to get back to Hoover before 7 o'clock, or they're going to put me in jail. And so I, like a dummy, rode on 459 for about, I don't know, past the, what's that, Statue of Liberty thing, until I got to Liberty 280. Park. Yeah, I was like, okay, that's enough of that. Motorcycles shouldn't ride on 459, so curfew sucks. I don't like it.
All right. Well, good talk.
Thank you, man.
Yeah,
thank you. Appreciate it.
Love you.
Love you, brother.
Two Americas is a production of I Can't Believe We're Having to Talk About This. For future episodes, please subscribe.